HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this latest episode, we hear from Marcus Shaw, Amy Randell, Hannah Saltis, and Jennifer Power, talking about the role parents and guardians play in the education and support of young people within sexual health.
Hi everyone, my name's Marcus Shaw. I am the manager of population health and community development at WAC. Today we're going to be talking about the role of parents and guardians play in the education and support of young people within sexual health. Before we start though, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of country and acknowledge their continuing connection to land, water, culture and community, and pay respects to elders past and present. So today I'm joined by three amazing people who I'll have introduce themselves in a second. But how today's podcast is going to work is we just have a few questions and we'll just have a bit of a discussion through those questions to see what, you know, answers and amazing topics we come up with. So Amy, would you like to introduce yourself first?
Oh, hi, my name's Amy Randell. I use she, her pronouns. I am an Officer of Population Health and Community Development at WAC. So I work within Marcus's team. My background, I worked in this role for coming up on 3 years. My background is I did my undergrad in human biology and then pivoted over to public health and did a master's in sexual and reproductive health. My experience working with young people, I worked as a volunteer, then also in my current role as well, working as an educator, then also in peer settings, talking about sexual health and everything that comes with within that as well. I'm not a parent myself, but I am an auntie to 8 little ones. So kind of see that in the role, both as like a trusted adult, obviously both in professional role, but then also in personal settings as well.
Awesome. Thanks, Amy. Hannah.
Hi, I'm Hannah Saltis. I work as a research officer at the Relationships and Sexuality Education Project. I've been there for about 5 years and I predominantly am in a research role. However, recently I have started teaching the undergraduate unit for all our health and phys ed teachers about relationships and sexuality education. I suppose one of the main areas that schools are really concerned with is parents and how to make sure parents are involved and also on board with relationships and sexuality education. So we've done a bunch of research around parent support, and also I really try to embed that in my lessons with the undergrads.
Great. Thanks, Hannah. And finally, Jen.
Hi, my name's Jan Power. I am the Deputy Director of the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University. And I also run our Sexual Health and Wellbeing Project or program. So within that role, we run quite a few studies on young people and sexual health. And we've recently completed a survey of parents and carers on what they find difficult and challenging when it comes to speaking to their children or teenagers about sex and relationships, which throw up some interesting findings. I do have 2 kids. I have a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old, so can also speak to some personal experience.
Great. Thanks, everyone. I think it'll be really nice to hear from everyone through these questions. It sounds like there's a different perspective that will be brought from each of you. So looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Our first question is just a pretty easy one, but can also kind of probably end up in a really long, huge waffle of a tangent. But if we can kind of keep it a bit succinct, can you define what sexual health means in relation to young people? And Amy, I might throw to you first.
Yeah. So I guess more broadly, I guess, talking about sexual health, really coming back to the World Health Organization definition of it being a set of physical, emotional, mental and social well-being related to sexuality. When it comes to, particularly we're talking about with young people, so children, teenagers, really that, and for adults as well, that sexual health really is an umbrella term and it's encompassing more than just sex and any kind of risks associated with sex, so STIs and pregnancy, but really looking at it as something that is a part of our kind of human experience. It's something that everybody experiences in their own way, and it really incorporates really how we relate to other people, for young people, how they relate to other people, the growth and development that they're going through, the different stages in life that they're going through as well. but I know Marcus said to keep it succinct, but one thing I just want to add in as well is that, you know, children aren't devoid of sexuality and sexual health, and that elements of sexual health don't really occur in isolation from one another either. So things that we kind of look at as quite developmental for young people really kind of change and evolve throughout their lifespan and inform what we talk about with adults as well as sexual health too. So kind of looking at it as situated within the kind of broader umbrella and experience of sexual health.
Yeah, nice. So kind of a bigger holistic approach and very normalizing in what you've had to say there. Jen or Hannah, do you have anything to add to Amy's definition there?
Actually, the definition of sexual health is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. We run the secondary students in sexual health surveys here at La Trobe, and part of what we need to do in there is work out a series of ticker box questions, you know, questions and answers to determine kind of what it means for someone to be sexually healthy. You know, what is beyond the absence of disease, or, you know, the absence of STIs or other sort of sexual health problems, if you like, you know, what does it mean for someone to be sexually healthy? So we go around and around and around in conversations about really how do we measure that? How would we know if someone's sexually healthy? And I think it comes down to kind of strengths and capacities. So, you know, feeling confident to communicate, having some sort of emotional insight into what you need and what you want and feeling like you're able to assert that is a kind of an important part of sexual health.
Yeah, nice. It's a great point, Jen, like highlighting the how you identify the positive and the strengths, because we often, it's probably easier to identify the disease or the burden or the issue, but just to highlight when people are doing well may not be as easy to recognise.
And it's also really hard to kind of translate that into a compelling argument for why you need funding for something. Like so often, you know, our funding models are determined by the absence of disease or getting rid of risks or harms, and it's so easy to fall back on that being the definition of sexual health or the way that we make sense of sexual health. Whereas if we're talking about, you know, the capacity to determine your own sex life in the way that you want to, you know, it's a much sort of harder sell, I guess, to say, you know, this is really what we're pushing for here, and this is what we're aiming for when we're investing in young people's sexual health. It's their capacity to really enjoy their sex life, have freedom of choice in their sex life, you know, to make decisions and assert what they need when it comes to that. Yeah. It's a weirdly harder sell than.
Yeah, absolutely. And as Amy highlighted, like the broadness of it as well, that it can just lead to social connection. Like it's not only about that, you know, sex specifically, that area, like there's so much that it does connect within the human experience. So being able to allow people to understand that as well can be a challenge.
I was just going to add in with that as well, I guess, with young people, and sometimes what might get dismissed for young people and for children is that complexity of sexual health at that age, that it's not just about their bodies developing or that, you know, getting ready for adulthood necessarily. Like, obviously, that's a big part of it, but it's there's complexities of those, also those experiences as well that young people have too, that they are, it is quite a, it's developmentally, it's a huge time in a person's life. So, yeah, kind of keep it kind of, how do we broaden that and how do we, yeah, going on what you were saying there, Jen, as well.
Nice. Hannah, did you have anything to add there?
No, I'd just like to probably reiterate what Jen touched on, which is the rights-based approach to sexual health. So it is considered a human right that young people and all people have access to information about all aspects of sexual health that we've obviously just stated it's very broad. So, and also the right to determine, you know, anything about their sexual lives throughout the lifespan. So I just wanted to, you know, just really highlight that rights base. And I love that we've spoken about the strengths-based approach. A lot of the work that we do at RSE Project is very much strengths-based and comes from a sex-positive approach. So making sure that people do know what that wellness is, because most young people that I speak to are really good at telling you what is not right, so they can recognize when people are not providing consent, when people are not practicing safer sex, all these kinds of things. But so giving them a framework to really figure out what a good, healthy, holistic, full sex life and sexual development looks like, I think is really key.
And giving parents that framework too.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I think there's a lot of reticence amongst parents to recognize sexual development, and that, you know, I attended a really fantastic talk last week, reiterated that sexuality is from birth to death, and that is a fact. It looks different throughout the whole lifespan, and I think we do a really good job of focusing on it around puberty and kind of teen years and that kind of thing, but I think parents really at a loss when it comes to those earlier years of development and sexual development, particularly in early childhood and that kind of thing.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Hannah. I think there's some really interesting points you've raised and that have been discussed here around sex positivity and strengths-based, because it may be parents who, or, you know, people of a parenting age now who are raising people who maybe were educated not through a strengths-based approach or through that, like, a sex-positive approach, but more from a fear-based approach or a very objective kind of factual approach, and may, you know, that's all that they know to then put onto their children, which is, yeah, something that hopefully we can discuss a little bit further here today. I might go back to you, Hannah, actually, while we're still talking there. But the next question is, how do we successfully manage this challenge of different expectations, understandings, and values of various cultures within Australia?
Oh, that is a huge question. And I'm not entirely sure that anyone has worked that out completely. I think something that I have noticed in a lot of my work is the most successful approaches include everybody's voices. So working together with community leaders and parents and teachers and schools, and making sure that everybody is on the same page about, I suppose, the key messages that we want to give to young people is super important. Something that we often forget as educators, or maybe we don't forget, but maybe it sort of goes to the back of our priorities, is a lot of people, particularly parents, haven't received any relationships and sexuality education throughout their life. They might have received some when they became pregnant. They might have received a little bit, as you said, of fear-based or like non-sex positive, very much like the basics, like don't get pregnant, don't get an STI, use a condom. They might have gotten something like that. But more often than not, when I'm running workshops, we usually ask, what kind of RSC have you had? And most people will say it's very, very basic. So a lot of people don't really understand what you are talking about when you're saying relationships and sexuality education. And what I've seen in the most successful schools, and I'm talking like primary schools, I'm talking like very like multi-faith, multicultural schools, is that they really include all of their leaders' voices, and they'll all do training, and they'll all together come up with an approach that is in the holistic best interests of their young people. So perhaps that includes, the cultural leaders coming in and delivering some kind of RSE in a way that aligns with the tenets of their faith. Maybe that includes the parents coming in and doing some parent information evenings with their kids. Like, usually it's best when everyone is involved at some level together. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and Hannah, have you seen that in practice, that you've seen a pretty successful,
Yeah, I've seen a number of really successful primary schools that we work with who will kind of get us in to just do a little bit of a pulse check, or if they've got a new issue that's arisen that they're not. So the most recent one was trying to include a couple of transgender students who had come out in the school. And again, very, very multicultural. They were anticipating a lot of backlash within the school. But when I really asked them, you know, about their approach, and I sort of probed it and gave them some ideas about what they could do in terms of getting the parents on board, and sort of asked them, like, have you actually seen this backlash? They were like, oh, no, I think most parents don't really care. No one's really come forward with any problems. And they have done a really good job of normalizing a lot of different sort of topics within RSE within this school. So it was just another, I think, way to slotted in into that. They have social and emotional well-being embedded into all of their learnings, and they kind of frame RSD within that realm. So yeah, I've seen it done exceptionally well in schools where also they are situated next to some faith-based centres, and so their leaders are in and out of the school, liaising with parents. It's just fantastic. Like, yeah, it's really incredible to see.
Yeah, great. And just a quick kind of yes or no, like, is that just being led by the leadership of the school that you've seen, that they've taken that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Just a couple of really dedicated individuals, yeah.
Yeah, great. Jen, what about yourself and the work you've done? I'm sure you've seen some successes.
Just going back to the question of how we sort of work across different cultures within Australia, I haven't necessarily seen successes, but it's a question I've thought quite a bit about lately. We recently did a bunch of interviews with young people who were second-generation migrants from Chinese backgrounds. And a lot of what those young people were talking about was the challenges that their parents have when it comes to talking about sex or relationships, both sort of sex or body-related topics, as well as the more emotional or intimate aspects of relationships, and also the restrictions that the parents placed on dating, the emphasis on things like, you know, no dating until after high school, that kind of thing. And it was interesting because those young people were really coming from the perspective of understanding both their parents' values, beliefs, you know, cultural background, as well as what they're learning in school. And they sort of saw it as a clash, but they also were very able to sort of navigate both, you know, and they were the ones sort of, I guess, bridging that cultural divide in some ways. And I think what that showed me was how we need to really be listening to young people whose parents may or may not be on board in the same way as other parents with what they're learning in school in terms of what they need, what's going to help them have conversations with their parents if and when that's appropriate, but not necessarily make assumptions that, you know, every family needs to be having the same conversations with their kids, or that we need to judge or push families to be the way we think they should be, because that's not necessarily going to work for all families, and it's not necessarily respectful of where those families are coming from. So I think there are different ways of working with families and different ways of working with young people, and we need to kind of tune into that on local levels, which it sounds like Hannah's examples have done really, really well. The other thing that came out in that study was just things came from unexpected places. So a lot of those young people said when they were growing up, the places where they had really great conversation about relationships were within their church groups. And some of that was, you know, in the vein of don't have sex until you're in a really meaningful relationship that's, you know, maybe going to lead to marriage. So sometimes we would look at that as kind of not sex positive or regressive conversations. But for these young people, they were really important. Like, it was a really great space for them to talk about what they needed. And the message that a lot of them said they got was about how to take care of themselves, or how to assert what they wanted and what they needed, and, you know, think about really what they wanted to do in terms of sex and relationships. So, yeah, it was a good lesson for me to look more broadly than the usual places in terms of where young people might be learning about.
Yeah, that's interesting. Amy, what about yourself? Any final points on that question?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really awesome to hear what Jen and Hannah have said as well about those kind of tangible kind of things that are happening in community as well. I think, yeah, coming back to talking about, like, this, we're kind of bridging between maybe, you know, between cultures and between groups as well. And, you know, like we said about the young people, bridging those gaps between cultures, but also where the kind of common values, there's still common themes across values and everything that we all have, whether it's well-being or safety of young people, whatever it might be as well. And really kind of coming back to, like you said, Jen, as well, we shouldn't be kind of expecting that all families are having the exact same conversation in the exact same way at home and the exact same age. But really, I guess, seeing how we can kind of, where those shared values are and supporting parents, or maybe that being kind of a link, or maybe an in with parents and with communities as well.
Absolutely. I think there's something as well that we're slowly getting better at listening and not just kind of charging on with what we believe is the best option. So I think that's come through of listening to those voices and the experts in those lived experiences there. Just a quick question here now. Is there such a thing as too young? to start talking about sexual health? I might jump back to you, Amy.
Very quick answer, no. I think going back to what we said with the definitions of what sexual health is, it's not sitting down with a two-year-old and talking about sex. That's not what we're talking about when it comes to sexual health. But I guess where we say as well, talking about sexual health, it's also how we model things as well. It's not just the conversations we have, but also the behaviours that we model as well to young people. Young people and children pick up cues way earlier than from when they start communicating and interacting with others, from what we see, that they're picking up cues about how to relate to other people, treatment of other people, also their own bodily autonomy and how that's respected as well is a really big thing too, that how we model and how we talk about these things, obviously at an appropriate kind of ages and stages, you know, relevant to their developmental stage, but really talking about things before things kind of happen. And that preventative, we're bringing it back to maybe people's interest might be listening to this podcast around, say we do want to talk around like STIs and HIV, that, you know, if we start talking before things happen, young people have the skills and the knowledge to be able to navigate, you know, relationships, intimate relationships when that time comes, if that time comes for them, then also around the, you know, knowing, not necessarily knowing one, what the risks are, but also what the choices that they have, and that strengths-based approach of what choices that they have and the autonomy that they have to make decisions best for themselves, to take care of their own health and their own well-being. I think it's never too early to have those conversations to set them up. Yeah, best to be able to understand and have a healthy relationship with themselves and with other people as well.
Yeah, great. I think modelling is a really great point there to bring up, that it's almost in that passive way of working, because we live in a sexualized world and young people will start to see sexualized things in whatever form that is from a very early age, just in going about their everyday lives. So I think that's a really important point. Jen, what are your thoughts? Is there any such thing as too young?
I think that's a really important question, because I reckon that's the thing that parents really worry about. We hear that again and again. It comes up in all sorts of research that parents really worry that they're going to say something inappropriate, or that they're talking about topics that their kids are too young to understand, or that something they say might be overtly or overly sexual for their child. It's this sort of pervasive cultural unknowing and fear about kids and sexuality, I think, that really can undermine parents' confidence to talk about anything to do with bodies, sexuality, sex with their kids. So that's why that's a really important question. And in answer to it, no, I don't think there is anything too early. Like, if you think about the conversations that parents might or should be having with their kids, it's kind of scaffolded, right? So when they're little, there's going to be conversations about body parts and understanding what the different body parts do, and understanding, you know, what you might do in private and what, you know, what you might be able to do around other people. But then also leading into where did babies come from, and reproduction and puberty. And like, it's sort of an ongoing series of conversations that should really be happening from when a child is young. There's a lot of guidance online about what's age appropriate for parents that are worried. But in general, I would think most parents are pretty good at judging what is okay. I think parents worry about it. And also, I think these conversations take practice for parents. So actually, it's one thing to be talking to your child for their benefit when they're little, about getting comfortable saying certain words. Like, you know, a lot of people ask them to say masturbation and they're a little bit, you know, immediately squirm. So for a parent to be having a conversation where they use words like masturbation in front of their kids, or, you know, in a conversation with their kids, takes a little bit of practice. Like, you kind of need to get yourself comfortable. So in some ways, if what you're doing is training yourself to, at appropriate times, when it comes up, when something's on TV, you know, when these issues are there, be raising conversations with your kids when they're young. You're practicing as well. You're getting better at it as they get older, so that by the time they're teenagers and you're having some really weird conversations that you never thought you'd be having with your child, believe me, add a little bit of practice. So, yeah, it's for both you and your child to start when they're young.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And we've had parents who I work with, who we work with and chatted to in the sector, who talk about sex all day, every day. And then as soon, they'll come in and be like, oh my God, I did it with my kid and it was weird. And
it's so much harder when it's your own kid. Yeah. It's just so much harder. And that's where you realize how much a professional barrier you're able to put up when you're in a professional role that you just can't do. And being able to talk about things that either you find a bit awkward or embarrassing or exposing, it's hard. It's hard in front of your kids, genuinely. It is difficult stuff for parents, even though it sort of shouldn't be on one. But it's genuinely very hard.
Mm. Hannah, just quickly, too young, what are your thoughts?
Well, firstly, I'd just love to thank Jen for acknowledging that, because I have a 16-year-old stepdaughter, and there are very like good theoretical conversations that we can have about lots of different topics, especially like if it comes up on TV or whatever. We're pretty open and it's pretty great, but there are some topics that I'm like, oh my gosh, how am I supposed to address that? Like, I thought that I would be fine, but actually I have to like really practice, and like maybe I'll practice with my partner, or maybe I'll practice with my therapist or something like that, where I'm like, oh my goodness, like I didn't realize. And it might even come from internalized stigma or shame around certain topics, for example. So thank you for acknowledging that. Too young, absolutely not. As Jen said, the word that I had in my mind, which was scaffolded. I'd just like to, I guess, give a plug to, there's a really great resource by the WA Department of Health called Talk Soon, Talk Often, which you can get a physical copy as a book. There's also one called Yarning Quiet Ways, which is for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and was developed alongside Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So it's culturally appropriate in that way to have these smaller conversations often. It's also now our website. And then Kath Hackerson also has a fantastic website called Sex Ed Rescue, which is to help parents start these conversations as well around a range of topics. And I know that she also hosts webinars and has like courses and things. So there is support for parents who are feeling a little bit awkward and uncomfortable about it. Again, just going back to the fact that a lot of times parents are having awkward conversations about things that are like maybe very uncomfortable, but we can also normalize having really positive conversations about bodies and what feels good without it being necessarily sexual. So like we often talk about like this really early development. We'll talk about early warning signs. We'll talk about, oh no, like what feels bad in your body and what to do if you feel bad in your body around somebody because somebody has made you feel uncomfortable and set off those early warning signs. But what we don't do a great job of is being like, oh, you know, it's really great when you touch your body here. It feels really good. And that's a really, to get a nice warm hug from someone feels really safe and warm, and really reiterating that those are really positive feelings that you might have about something. So if someone makes you feel really safe and warm and cozy and happy, then that's probably a good person to be around. Things like that, which also scaffold those conversations later on about consent, about, you know, choosing a partner that is good for you, that kind of thing, healthy relationships rather than, you know, going from a gender-based violence perspective or a violence prevention perspective. We can really get those positive frameworks and those strength-based approaches from young as well. And I guess the other thing is young people have questions, and kids, toddlers, you know, as soon as they start to really understand the world around them or want to understand the world around them, will have questions. So I guess it's being able to answer those questions in that age-appropriate way, and just giving limited information. So, for example, like I heard an amazing chap talking about having a conversation with his child about, you know, what feels good in his body, and then scaffolding that up as he got older to talk about, you know, different scenarios where different behaviours were appropriate, so the public and private conversations and things like that, and not doing that straight away, because you don't need to do that straight away, and you can kind of do it as it becomes relevant and appropriate, and yeah, building on those earlier conversations, as Jen said.
That's a really great answer. Thank you. Now, I am mindful of time, so I think this next question around what advice would you give to parents, guardians for approaching sexual health conversations with people, with their young people? Yeah, if you've got one, two, three, kind of what would be your key pieces of advice? Jen, we might start with you.
First one, I would say be curious. You don't need to approach these conversations with answers. Actually, what you want to do is be encouraging your children or teenagers to talk to you. So actually asking them questions, what do you think about what the news says on pornography or whatever, and being genuinely curious about their opinions. One, shows respect for them, shows interest, you learn about them, and it continues to open that line of conversation. So don't go in expecting to be an expert. In fact, it's way better to go in not being an expert and asking your young person what they think. Also, I reckon own the nerves and the awkwardness and the embarrassing things, because again, that kind of builds a little bit of openness to the conversation. So actually just saying, oh, I'm so embarrassed having this conversation could be a way to kind of, you know, make that ground a little bit funny or a little bit, you know, create a point of connection with the person that you are talking with. And also I would reiterate Talk Swing Talk Often is a really good resource. And the point Hannah said earlier about practicing, like don't assume that these conversations are going to go well. You might want to chat to your partner first or chat to yourself in the mirror or chat to anyone. But also if it doesn't go well, it just doesn't matter. Like try it again, you know, keep on trying, raise it. Doesn't always pop up, but sometimes it does.
Amy, what about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Reiterating everything that agreeing with what Jen said there as well. I think going for what you said, Jen, also and being the one to initiate those conversations or kind of taking those first kind of steps. And parents, I think give themselves a little bit of grace. They may already be kind of initiating these conversations or modeling these behaviors and not realizing it as well. So because there's so much pressure on parents to get it right and to, you know, go by the book, but they're probably already doing so much there. So recognizing what they're doing, but I think, yeah, initiating the conversation, the young people may have so many questions, but not leaving it just up to them to be the ones to come forward with their questions, expecting that they'll just come to speak to you if they're not, these aren't kind of topics or conversations that are normalized within the household or normalized within your relationship, that even if they don't come to you with questions right away, but keeping that door open, you know, starting those conversations, using those opportunistic kind of learning things that come up, you know, whether it is on the radio or what's on TV, and kind of play so that just modeling that behavior that and the attitudes that it's okay to talk about these things, and when they do have questions or they do want to talk about something, that they can come and speak to you as a trusted adult as well. It doesn't have to be that they suddenly open up overnight, but it may be that, you know, one day when they do have that conversation, they want to have that conversation, that they know you'll be there to have that with them, and that can be really powerful for a young person.
Yeah, I think an important part of that as well is how you respond when they are asking questions or saying things that maybe they're seeing their friends doing or that they're wanting to do or something, and not having kind of a negative immediate shutdown response, because that will probably stop them from wanting to come to you later. But, you know, allowing that space to happen, even though it might be your initial response to just want to say like, no, or jump right in. And Hannah, what about yourself? A couple of points there for advice.
Yeah, well, I firstly think both of the points of, you know, Jen and Amy have raised excellent points so far that it's kind of leaving me struggling to think of some things. I guess, like, Jen mentioned being curious, and I think being curious as to the questions themselves. So, like, for example, sometimes young people will come to you with a question, and I heard a great phrase recently, which was adult brains will interpret adult content. So just, like, you know, depending on the age of your child, if they ask you a question that you see as being kind of like an adult question, maybe like probing further. Like, I know one of my colleagues uses the example about a child in year 2 or 3 asking if their bunny could get HIV, and her brain going off like, oh my goodness, am I going to have to talk about bestiality? Am I going to have to? No. She went, sorry, why do you ask that question? What makes you ask that question? And she'd seen a documentary about HIV and was just worried that her bunny could get sick because she loved her bunny, and she was like, I don't want my bunny to get sick, so is that a possibility? And so then she said, that's not a possibility because this is only in humans. So that kind of thing where you're really approaching questions with curiosity and meeting them where they're at, rather than trying to jump to like over elaboration on things. And then I guess the other thing that I would say, I guess from personal experience, is even if you've created like the most open and like approachable environment, or you think you've done that, maybe your teenager does not want to talk to you specifically. So it's about creating a village. Is there someone else that your kid can go to ask these questions if they don't want to come to you, despite you being a very open person? Maybe they just really have their own hang-ups about asking those questions. Are they able to locate good information on the internet? Not just like the first TikTok video that comes up, but like, are they able to find the sexual health resources that they need? Do they have that kind of literacy to kind of engage with external information as well? So, I mean, in an ideal world, you're having all these conversations and you're doing it all, like, you know, whether it's perfect or whether it's like a bit like more likely higgledy-piggledy and ad hoc. That's great, but if they really don't want to talk to you about it for whatever reason, who else can they go to? Making sure that they have people that they can go to in their lives, whether that's at school or whether there is like a church or another faith-based kind of centre that they're going to, that might be able to give them information. And also, and parents just being a bit proactive in the school space as well. So find out what your school is teaching them about this. That might actually be a really good way for them to, for the parents, I mean, to go and start these conversations. Oh, I heard that you're learning about X in school. What have you learned about it? Tell me what you're learning, that kind of thing. Whereas I think there's a lot of onus on schools to, like, communicate with their parents specifically about RSE. So some schools are really worried to do that because they perceive a lot of backlash from parents. So if you're a parent that's really keen to hear about this and to start these conversations, make sure your school knows about it, because likely they're only hearing about the parents who don't want to hear about it as well.
My daughter is doing relationships and sexuality education at school at the moment, and they send home homework for parents. So I had to fill in this crossword of what different terms that they've learned in their class, how much I knew about these issues. It was such a good idea for this school, whoever was running the education. It was really good, because it was a really non-threatening way for her to speak to me about what she'd been learning. It was really good. It's nice.
That's awesome, yeah. Jen. That's so cool.
That's pretty cool. I got all of the things on this way.
And it worked well, Jen, like it opened up a nice kind of safe conversation and space.
Yeah, because it was really led by her. So she was able to say, oh, I've got this, it was sort of a quiz, like you filled in the crossword. So she was able to pick the quiz to me. And so I had a chance to kind of ask questions about what she learned about that. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. So, yeah, it seems like something that teachers have identified, that parents need to be brought along on a bit of this journey. So they're bringing them in a way that is possible. That's really great by the school. Now, just finally, Hannah's touched on some great points there around resources and you know, bringing other people along and having support, because this isn't something that, you know, parents have to do on their own. And this is our final question. If you have any resources or services that you would like to promote or talk about that you think are amazing. So we have talked about Talk Soon, Talk Often and Yarn in Quiet Ways for Aboriginal people. Were there any other resources or services? Amy, start with you.
First thing that comes to mind is there's so many different videos and kind of short kind of content and everything out there for all different ages. I know amaze.org, which I believe is based in America, they've got really good kind of comprehensive videos, quite funny as well, that young people could, there's ones that maybe young people could watch themselves, or like you could watch like as a parent with a young person. I think finding, it's kind of like building our own kind of toolkit, and also for people working with parents or working with young people as well, like kind of building that little toolkit of, yeah, like videos or also, I guess, social media pages as well. So in Perth, we've got the, ONWA, we've got the Youth Educating Peers Project, the YEP Project. They've got really great Instagram videos and posts as well that recommend, you know, for parents to maybe they can share with it. If they have a teenager that's on social media, that they can share with, so that they can find that kind of information as well. I think, yeah, the ones I recommend.
Yeah, great. Jen?
Look, for parents, I actually wouldn't go past Talk Often. But there are some other really good ones out there. So the Parenting Resource Centre has some. There's quite a few kind of government-backed websites for parents. The other thing, though, I would suggest for parents is to have a look around the community-focused websites that they can send to their teenagers. There's so many around right now. There used to be a great one called Scarleteen in the US.
Still
there?
Yeah.
So, post anonymous questions, and that's always been the one that I hear about the most.
Right, and Hannah?
Like, yeah, just reiterating what these two have said, and also what I said earlier about Kath Hackettson's parent sex ed rescue, which is a great resource for parents and has like a wealth of resources within that resource. And then like also like I'm a bit old school in that I can't go past a book. Like, you know, I've just seen so many fantastic different books from so many fantastic people. I know there's like ones on various issues, like there's ones on like really simple like picture books and children's books, even about like the idea of, you know, being trans, but it's like about a teddy bear, and the teddy bear at the end of the story changes their name or something. It's very simple, very easy for kids to understand, and very non-confronting. Lots of stuff around bodies, you know, Everybody's Got a Bottom is a fantastic book. And then, like, as they get older, Uni Stimes and Dr. Melissa Kang, like, oh my goodness, like, all of their books, just can't recommend enough. I know Lucy Peach has some great books about periods and menstruation. There are so many books out there. And what I love about books is you can kind of, they're there, it's non-screen time. It's time for them to just, like, process. They can pick it up, put it down. They can even just be on the shelf as a reminder, like, if you want to talk about this, this is a safe topic. I know that we've got a book on the shelf called Sex is a Funny Word, which was given to my stepdaughter Maylee when she was, like, I don't know, like, 8 or something. And, you know, these kinds of things, just normalising it from an early age, and, like, we know that you've heard this word. What does it mean? Why do people get all funny when they hear it? That's probably all I'd add to that.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And I think it's important to note as well around resources and videos and everything online, that in a world of kind of misinformation now, like, doing a bit of that background work to see, how is this government backed? Are they funded by the government, or is it done by researchers, or is it someone, what's their degree and what's their background professionally? You know, looking at reviews of books, if they are more children's books or anything like just doing that extra little step just to make sure the work that, or the information you are looking at and looking into is actually the best practice, evidence-based information.
For parents, I don't think, don't be scared of online resources. Mm. Parents try to shut down their kids going online to learn about sex, and actually there's great stuff online for young people to learn about sex in private at their own pace. So if you're able to check out the background, as we were just saying, and feed them some links, that'd be a good start. But don't be too scared. Try and encourage them to use that resource and be critical about what they're reading online and talk to them about what they're seeing. But don't try and shut it down or tell them not to do it, or we just close off that line of communication.
Absolutely. Kids, that's the real skill there, is giving them the tools to be able to find out the information as well. Great. Thank you all so much for your time. This has been really informative and useful. I'm sure when this is published on HIV Australia, there will be some additional space there for everyone's contact information. So if for those who are listening, if you'd like to reach out to any of the amazing panel members today, please do. Thank you all again.
Thank you.